Jefferson Davis in the twilight of the Confederacy. He had been a leader of the Klan and the American Nazi Party and the friend of every white supremacist group in the country. Then he discovered religion and was born again and wore his spirituality like a uniform. He had served in the Louisiana legislature and run for the presidency and the United States Senate. Then he went to Russia to promote his latest anti-Semitic book. While he was out of the country, the FBI got a warrant on his house and found his mailing list. He had been selling subscriptions to his racist publications and concealing the income from the IRS. Later, the multicultural nature of the prison shower room was not his favorite conversational subject. Bobby Earle was his name, and manipulation was his game. During the peak of his career, women who affected the dress of Southern belles lined up to be photographed with him. Then the plastic surgeon's handiwork began to soften and deteriorate and slip from the bone, and Bobby Earle's face took on the appearance of wax held to a flame. His hair fell out, too, and he wore a wig that resembled barbershop sweepings glued to a plastic skullcap. While attending an anti-America, anti-Israel convention in Iran, he was interviewed on CNN and reduced by Wolf Blitzer to a raging idiot while spittle flew from his lips. The hostess started to seat Cleet and me at a small table. "We're with Mr. Nemo," I said.
"Are you sure? He didn't tell me others would be joining him," she said.
Cleet waved at Tony. "Sorry we're late, big guy," he said. The hostess took us to the table and walked away quickly. "You don't mind, do you, Tony?" I said. He looked up from his shrimp cocktail.
"We're eating here!"
Cleet and I opened our menus. Cleet turned to Juju and Maximo. "What do you guys recommend?" Neither answered.
"You drink your breakfast, Purcell?"
Tony said. "Actually, I did. A protein shake with bananas and strawberries," Cleet said. "You ought to try it." Tony stuck his finger in one ear and wiped it on the tablecloth.
"You followed me in here?"
"We were in the neighborhood," I said. "How's it going, Bobby?"
"I'm fine, thank you."
"The Advocate says Jimmy Nightingale is trying to distance himself from you," I said. "I think you're getting a dirty deal."
"Yeah, me too," Cleet said.
He hit Earl hard between the shoulders, slanting his wig. I caught the waiter's attention and ordered iced tea and a dozen raw oysters. Cleet ordered a po' boy sandwich and a vodka Collins. A black busboy filled our water glasses and took away an empty bread basket and brought back a full one. Tony called the manager over.
"That colored kid don't come close to this table again, unless he's got white gloves on, clear?"
"Yes, sir, Mr. Nemo," the manager said, bending stiffly.
"What are you looking at?"
Tony said to me.
"Nothing," I replied. He waited for me to go on, but I didn't.
"You being cute?"
he asked.
"A play on words or something?"
"Not me," I said. Cleet ordered a second vodka Collins.
"If this has something to do with Bobby, I want you two guys to lay off him,"
Tony said. I saw Earl's face color, his pale blue eyes looking straight ahead.
"What are you guys here for?"
Tony said.
"Don't you talk shit to me either."
Cleet took a long drink from his glass. "We were passing by and happened to see you and thought you could help us with something. See, there's this ex-con named Kevin Penny, and there's speculation that somebody might have sicked him on Dave for messing up a movie deal with Levon Broussard. You got some movie deals hanging, Tony? I hear your films are great."
Tony's eyes seemed to cross as he tried to ingest Cleet's words. In the meantime, Bobby Earle seemed to be going through an internal meltdown while he picked through the way Tony had marginalized him. He sipped from his water glass and blotted his lips with his napkin.
"I'm not the same person I was when I went to prison. I belong to an evangelical reading group now. I'm trying to make amends for my past life. I think of all people, you would understand that, Dave. May I call you Dave? You treated me harshly once, but I forgave you. Can you do the same?"
Cleet trained his Collins. The waiter began putting our food on the table.
Hit me again on this, will you? Cleet said, pointing to his glass. He looked at Earl. You walk the walk, Bobby. Fucking A.
People at other tables turned in their chairs.
Are you mocking me? Earl said.
Are you kidding? I always thought Jimmy Nightingale was a fraud and a four-flesher. Look how he treated Tony. He takes the Civil War sword Tony bought to give to Levon Broussard and gives it to Broussard himself. Now he's got a rape beef coming down on his head, and he'll probably give up anybody he can to save his own sorry ass.
What rape beef?
Tony said.
A well-known lady has brought charges. You can check out the particulars yourself. This guy Penny says Nightingale has got a cut of the action in Jeff Davis Parish. Maybe elsewhere as well. Now that he's in trouble, maybe he'll give up some names. The guy's NCAA, no class at all.
Tony made a wet sucking sound in his throat.
You think you're smart?
I was keeping you up to date on your boy Nightingale, Tony, Cleet said. I gotta hit the head. Don't choke on that oyster.
Take this thought with you, smart guy. I bought a bunch of your markers, 20 cents on the dollar. Now you owe me, not the Shylock.
Cleet stared at him in disbelief.
Yeah, you heard right, Tony said. Now go piss.
My cell phone rang. It was Helen, but the connection was bad. I went outside on the sidewalk. The air was cool and dank in the shade and had a winey smell like old Europe. A garbage truck clattered past. Helen, I said.
Where are you?
She asked.
In the quarter, eating lunch with Fat Tony and Bobby Earl.
What's Earl doing there?
Cadging favors.
You need to get back here.
What happened? I said. My head was still pounding with the revelation that a man like Tony the Nose had bought part of Cleet's debt.
Rowena Broussard cut her wrists. She's at Iberia General. She says nobody believes her account of the assault. She's putting it on you and me. Levon is yelling his head off.
About what?
He thinks Iberia General isn't up to his standards. He wants his wife transferred to Our Lady of the Lake in Baton Rouge. I'll wrap things up here and head back.
What's going on with Tony Nemo?
Trouble.
I looked through the restaurant window. Cleet was gone from the table. So were Juju and Maximo.
I'll call you back, I said.
Cleet was standing at the urinal when he heard Maximo and Juju come through the door. A man wearing a suit was urinating next to him. The man zipped his pants and began combing his hair in the mirror.
Go outside, man,
Maximo said.
Why?
The man said.
We got to unstop a pipe. You need to be somewhere else.
The man took one look at the expression on Maximo's face and went out the door. Cleek turned on the faucet and watched Maximo and Juju in the mirror.
Don't do this.
You got to come out in the alley, Juju said.
No, I don't.
Tony says we got to talk, Maximo said.
Tell him to boogie, Max,
Cleek said.
In 6 months, the state of Louisiana will be installing a pay toilet on Tony's grave.
What happens later, don't change nothing now, Maximo said. What you got in your coat pocket?
Cleet squeaked off the faucet and jerked 2 brown paper towels from the dispenser and dried his hands.
Talk to him, Juju.
Juju looked like someone had fitted a garrote around his neck.
I got my job to do, Purcell.
Bad choice of words, Cleet said.
No, bad choice of everything for you, man,
Maximo said. Cleet put a hand into his coat pocket for his blackjack, one that was shaped like a darning sock and weighted with lead and attached to a spring in a wood grip. But Maximo had already clicked on the stun gun he held behind his back. He touched it to Cleet's spine, and more than 15,000 volts flowed into Cleet's body. Cleet felt a pain like a bucket of nails tearing their way through his insides, dropping into his genitals, buckling his knees, and making him speak in a voice he didn't recognize.
He pulled himself half erect and tried to swing the blackjack at Maximo's head. It flew from his fingers into the toilet stall. Cleet stumbled along the wall, knocking over the trash can, his eyes bloodshot and stinging.
"We ain't finished, man," Maximo said. "It don't do no good to run."
Cleet felt the sharp edges of a condom machine. He fitted his fingers around it and tore it loose in a cloud of plaster and smashed it on Maximo's head. Juju was reaching inside his coat for a small five-shot titanium Colt 38 special he carried in a nylon holster under his coat. Cleet drove the condom machine like a cinder block straight into his face. Maximo lay half upright against the wall. Juju was bent over the sink, teeth and blood and saliva stringing into his cupped hand. Cleet wet a handful of paper towels and pressed them to Juju's mouth.
"Jesus Christ, Juju! Why'd you guys do this? What's the matter with y'all?"
Juju spat a tooth into the sink, unable to answer. The door swung back on its hinges. Fat Tony stood in the hallway, one hand propped on his cylinder cart, his lungs wheezing. Two uniformed cops stood behind him.
"I got your balls in a vice, Purcell. Your new home is Shitsville. How's it feel, Blimpo?"
Chapter 13 Maximo and Juju went to the hospital and Cleet went to the can. I called Helen and told her I'd be late getting back to New Iberia.
"What happened?" she asked.
I told her, in detail.
"I don't believe this," she said. "Have you lost your mind?"
"New Orleans does that to you." She hung up. In the morning, I went to Iberia General to visit Rowena Broussard, less out of concern for her than the fact that she had blamed her attempted suicide on Helen and me. She was out of intensive care and propped up on the bed in a sunny room that gave onto Bayou Teche and live oaks strung with Spanish moss. Her lips were gray, her face pale, her wrists heavily bandaged. A glass of ice water sat on the table next to her. Water had been spilled on the table.
"Levon just left," she said.
"I came to see you," I said.
"I forgot. It's a felony to commit suicide in Louisiana."
"How about losing the victim routine?"
"You're a hard-nosed wanker, aren't you?"
I sat in a chair next to her bed and picked up her water glass. I held the straw to her mouth. She drank from it and laid her head back on the pillow.
"What's a wanker?" I said. "A fucking seppo who doesn't know where to plant his bishop."
I thought it better not to pursue any more Australian definitions. "I heard you put your suicide attempt on Sheriff Swallow and me," I said.
"You're right. That's probably not fair. There was nothing good on the telly, so I thought I'd shuffle off to the crematorium."
"Were you ever treated for depression?"
"Leave the psychoanalysis at the door, if you would."
"I've had a long relationship with depression, Rowena. It eats at you in ways you can't describe to others."
"That's why you're a juicer?"
"I'm a juicer because I chose to be one." Her eyes held on mine, perhaps with curiosity or disdain. I had no idea who she was. I went to the window and gazed down at the bayou. A Union flotilla came down the Teche in 1863. 20,000 Yankee soldiers marched right past the site of this hospital. They raped slave women and set fire to plantation homes up and down the bayou. Thomas Jefferson said, "I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just."
"Tell me there's a drop of sense in that, because it sounds like drivel."
"I think Jefferson was saying that justice eventually comes about, but often in an imperfect way. I'm saying, I don't know if you'll get the justice you deserve."
"You're going to let him get away with this?"
"I didn't say that."
"Maybe there are others he's attacked."
"That's not his reputation." "Wrong words."
"I'm the exception. Just out of nowhere, he turns into a rapist."
at least that we know about.
That's a grand explanation. You're not responsible for information you're too lazy to find out about. Lovely.
Jimmy Nightingale has no history of abusing women. His problem is ambition and besting his father,
who, I understand, was a walking penis. This gets better all the time. Would you please get the fuck out?
I left without saying goodbye. I couldn't blame her for her anger, but I wasn't sympathetic with it either. She seemed to nurse it as a friend at the expense of others. I believed Rowena Broussard might take up residence in a black box for the rest of her life. Out in the corridor, I heard the elevator door open and found myself looking at the last person I expected to see at Iberia General that particular day. He looked fresh and radiant, as though he had just wakened from a good night's sleep and was ready to start a new day. A bouquet of flowers and an electric blue vase was cradled in his arms. "Are you going where I think you're going?" I said.
"I couldn't find anybody to bring the flowers up, so I brought them myself," Jimmy Nightingale said. "Will you take them the rest of the way?"
"I just got 86. I wouldn't advise going in there."
"That bad, huh?"
"What do you expect?" I said.
"She knows what happened, or rather, what didn't happen. I think she's a bit of a thespian. Is Levon here?"
"No."
"I'll toggle in and toggle back out."
"Leave her alone, Jimmy."
"Sorry."
He started to walk around me. "I'm speaking to you as an officer of the law. You're not going into that room."
"You're showing poor form, Dave."
"If you go in there, you're going to be under arrest."
"Then you'd better get your handcuffs out."
The elevator door opened again. Levon Broussard stepped into the corridor. He remained motionless, staring at us, his lanky frame backlit by a window. His face was as empty as a bread pan. He walked toward us, his eyes never leaving my face, completely ignoring Nightingale.
"Why is this lizard standing in front of my wife's hospital room?"
"People are what they do, not what they think, not what they say. But I think we all have moments when we realize we never quite know a person in his or her totality."
"I brought your wife flowers," Nightingale said. "I'd appreciate your not referring to me in a derogatory way."
Levon didn't take his eyes off me.
"Get him out of here, Dave."
"Everything is under control here," I said, raising my hand.
"Only a psychopath would do something like this," Levon said.
"Give us a minute here," I said. "No, I will not," Levon said.
"You don't know how much I admire your novels and your wife's art," Nightingale said. "Drunk or sober, I would never do either of you harm. For God's sake, use reason, man."
Levon watched a black custodian drag a wheeled bucket of soapy water down the corridor. Then he looked at Nightingale and the electric blue vase and the roses inside it.
"Thank you, sir. I'll take care of those."
His fingers were long and tapered like a pianist's or a basketball player's. He took the vase from Nightingale and walked to the elevator and pushed the button. When the doors opened, he lobbed the vase inside and watched the doors close again. He walked past us to the custodian and handed him a crisp $50 bill.
"I had an accident in the elevator," he said. "Sorry to make trouble for you."
"It's all right, sir," the black man said. Then Levon turned around and walked calmly toward Nightingale and me.
"Woe,"
I said. "Woe unto thyself," he replied. He grabbed Nightingale by the lapels and crashed him into the wall, pinning him against it, staring straight into his eyes. Then he gathered all the spittle in his mouth and spat it in Nightingale's face. I placed my hand on Levon's arm. "That's enough." He released Nightingale and stepped backward. I moved between him and Nightingale. "Let's go, Jimmy." Nightingale wiped his face on his sleeve. His skin was discolored, as though it had been freeze-burned. His eyes were full of tears. "Did you hear me?" I said. "I'll walk with you to your car."
"Yes, let's do that," he replied. I rested my hand on his shoulder. We'll take the stairs.
That would be fine. He started to look back. Step along now, I said.
It's funny how things can go amiss, isn't it? A wrong word here, a misunderstanding there. I don't think I'll ever quite get over this.
Let it slide, Jimmy.
There's nothing like moralizing at the expense of another, is there? I must learn the art of it.
I accompanied him to his car and then went back to the office. Cleet called just before noon. Maximo and Juju hadn't filed charges. Cleet had paid a fine at guilty court and was back on the street.
I'll be in New Iberia this afternoon.
Did Tony Nemo actually buy your markers?
If he did, he screwed himself. I already paid them off.
I don't think Fat Tony will see it that way.
He's one step away from worm food and knows it. You know what I think? Every one of these bastards is scared shitless of dying.
The gospel, according to Cletus Purcell. That evening brought rain and an ink-washed sky and the throbbing of hundreds of frogs. The air was sweet and cold, and I put on a jacket and opened a can of sardines and poured the juice on top of Tripod's old hutch and set the can inside next to a bowl of water, careful not to get the smell on my hands or clothes. Then I sat in a big wooden deck chair outfitted with water-resistant cushions and watched the light go out of the sky and the shadows disappear from the bayou's surface and the alligator gars rolling like serpents on the edge of the lily pads. The house was dark except for Alifair's bedroom, where she was working on her film adaptation of Levon Broussard's Civil War novel. Boys who had been playing softball in the park had left for the evening, and one by one the flood lamps above the diamond clicked off. I felt my eyes closing and a great fatigue seeping through my body, one that I did not argue with, in the same way that, at a certain age, you do not argue with the pull of the earth. In my dream, I saw the boys in tattered gray and butternut brown marching through the trees in the park. A sergeant with a kepi canted on his brow, high-stepping and counting cadence. I walked along beside them and spoke to them in both English and French, once again expecting them to pass by without acknowledging me, but this time was different. They were gesturing, waving me into their ranks. "Now?" I said.
"What better time?" the sergeant said. His cheeks were spiked with blonde whiskers, his uniform sun-faded and stiff with salt, white light radiating from a hole in his chest.
"I have a daughter who needs me."
"We all get to the same place. She'll be joining us one day as well."
"You wouldn't talk like that if you had a daughter."
"I had a son, though. The blue belly who put a ball through my heart didn't care about him or me."
"If God had a daughter, I bet he wouldn't have let her die on a cross."
"Then perhaps you belong among the quick. Right you are, sir. Top of the evening to you."
The column disappeared inside the fog. I felt a weight bounce sharply on my lap and tumble off my knees. I thought I had wakened, then realized I was still dreaming, because I saw a raccoon waddling through the leaves, his furry tail flicking like a fat spring. I fell deeper into my sleep, into a place that was cool and warm at the same time, when the year was 1945, and people in my community spoke only French, and on festival days danced under the stars with the innocence of medieval folk. Someone shook my arm hard and steady. "Wake up, Dave." I looked up at Alifair's face. "Better come in before you get rained on," she said. I stood up off balance.
"What a dream."
"You were laughing. I thought a big coon jumped in my lap."
"Better take a look at your trousers."
The muddy paw prints were unmistakable. There was a gummy smear on one thigh. I touched it and smelled my fingers.
"What is it?" she said.
"Sardines.
Maybe he got in somebody's trash."
Coons don't jump in people's laps.
Tripod did, she said.
He sure did. How you doing, Alfenheimer?
Why are you acting so weird?
I'll take weird over rational any day of the week, I said. The next day I went to the office of the Broussard family physician, Melvin LeBlanc.
Now what? He said.
Rowena cut her wrists right above the palms, I said.
Yes.
If you're serious about going off planet, you do it higher up, don't you?
People are not in a rational state when they try to take their lives, he replied.
Am I right or not, Doc?
They do it here. He drew two fingers high up on his inner forearm. He gazed innocuously out the window.
Is there something else you want to tell me?
No.
Let me rephrase. Is there something else you feel I should know?
I'd like to have you banned from my office. How about that?
I held his eyes. Rowena had medical training in Australia, he said. She nursed Indians in South America, what we used to call meatball medicine.
She wasn't serious about getting to the barn?
This doesn't mean she wasn't assaulted.
Thanks for your time, I said. Chapter 14. That night, Allifair played tennis with friends at Red Lurille's Health and Racket Club in Lafayette. The night was black, the lights over the court iridescent with humidity, the walking sounds of tennis balls and the huffing and shouts of the players a celebration of spring and rebirth. When Allifair's friends quit for the evening, she wiped herself off with a towel and began hitting on the backboard. A woman in a pleated tennis skirt and a white sweater cut off at the armpits with black hair pulled back as tightly as wire walked up behind her, spinning the shaft of a racket in her left palm.
Like to have another go at it?
Pardon?
Allifair said.
You're Allifair Robichaud. I recognize you from the photo on your book jacket.
Yes,
Allifair said.
I'm Emmeline Nightingale.
Are you?
Jimmy Nightingale's cousin and bookkeeper. My partner didn't show. I was hoping to hit a few.
I was about to head back to New Iberia.
Maybe another time, then.
Your last book was marvelous.
Thank you. I read you graduated at the top of Stanford Law. Look, I didn't mean to do anything inappropriate. I know who your father is, and I know he's talking to Jimmy about some legal matters.
No, that has nothing to do with my situation, Allifair said.
Well, anyway, I wanted to introduce myself and tell you how much I admire your writing.
Damn it, I wanted to play tonight. If you like, we can volley a bit.
Emmeline went to the far end of a nearby court and began dancing on the balls of her feet. Allifair went to the baseline and bounced the ball once, then hit it leisurely across the net. Emmeline returned it in the same way, smiling, showing no sense of competitiveness, making sure the return always went to Allifair's forehand. Then, for no apparent reason, she swung the racket hard, rolling it with her wrist and top-speeding the ball so it scotched the surface of the court and flew past Allifair's reach.
Good shot, Allifair said, ignoring the breach of protocol. Sorry, I was still thinking about my partner not showing up, Emmeline said.
They stroked the ball back and forth. Then Allifair hit to Emmeline's left side and advanced on the net, intending to create a routine pepper game. Emmeline returned the ball with a two-arm backhand that slashed the ball like a BB into Allifair's face. Allifair lowered her racket and pressed her wrist to her mouth. Emmeline ran to the net.
Are you all right? I'm sorry. I don't know why I did that.
I'm fine, Allifair replied. You didn't know I was coming to the net. It's my fault.
Here, let me see, Emmeline said. Your lip is cut. Let's go inside. I'll get some ice.
It's nothing.
Let's have a cold drink, please. I feel awful.
Really, I'm okay.
Please, Emmeline said.
Allifair slipped the cover onto her racket and zipped it up. She looked at her automobile in the lot. Emmeline touched a Kleenex to Allifair's chin and showed it to her.
Come on. We have to take care of that.
After Allifair went to the restroom, she joined Emmeline in the health bar.
Emmeline ordered ice fruit drinks for them and put the charge on her bill.
I took a chance. You like strawberries and pineapple, don't you?
Sure.
The ice will stop the swelling. Go ahead, drink.
Alifair looked at Emmeline's reflection in the mirror. The woman's face was flushed, her breath short, as though from exertion or excitement.
You seem a little tense, Alifair said.
I have a confession to make.
What's that?
I recognized you not only from your photo, but from the university library. You were asking the reference librarian about Civil War maps and the Union occupation of southwestern Louisiana. You told her you were writing a screenplay.
That's true.
Can I ask about what?
Reconstruction and the White League and a Confederate veteran who teaches a former slave girl to read and write.
What's the White League?
The Klan were amateurs in comparison. The White League took over New Orleans in 1872 and shot James Longstreet.
You know what the story sounds like?
Alifair didn't answer.
Levon Broussard's Civil War novel, based on his ancestors.
Could be, Alifair said.
It is, isn't it?
In Hollywood, historical stories are called period pieces. They're toxic. Think Cold Mountain. I'm doing what's called a treatment. It's a lark more than anything.
I think Levon Broussard's novel is a great book. The first movies were westerns, weren't they? At some point, movies will have to go back to their origins, won't they?
Alifair pushed her drink back toward the edge of the bar. She touched her lip.
You think I've stopped bleeding?
Do you have a formal situation with Levon?
Maybe you should ask him.
I would, except for that Australian bitch he calls a wife.
Alifair looked at her watch.
I'd better be going.
Emmeline moved her hand on top of Alifair's.
Bitch is kind. She's trying to ruin my cousin's life.
I'll be leaving now, Miss Emmeline.
Emmeline worked her fingers around Alifair's hand. Her skin felt moist and hot, her fingers squeezing like tentacles.
Hear me out. Regardless of what people say, Jimmy has a tender conscience. He worries over things other people wouldn't give a second thought about. You ever hang around the CEOs in the oil business? They let others do their dirty work.
I'm not sure what we're talking about. Please release my hand.
Sorry. Meet this collection of shits and tell me how you like it. You have no idea what they do in the Third World.
Alifair couldn't track the sequence. She got off the stool.
Dave worries about me.
Then call him.
Be seeing you around, I'm sure.
Emmeline's eyes seemed to take Alifair's inventory.
Top of your class at Stanford Law. That's impressive. But somebody has to do it, right?
Not necessarily.
Alifair went out the glass doors and didn't look back. She felt a rivulet of blood running from one nostril. When she started her car, her heart was thudding in her ears, as though evil could insinuate its way into a person's life without consent. In the morning, I received a call from the coroner, Cormac Watts.
"What's with your colleague?" he said.
"Which colleague?"
"Spade Labiche."
I looked through the glass on my office door. As coincidence would have it, Labiche was passing by. He cocked his thumb and index finger like a pistol and aimed it at me, winking. "What about him?" I asked.
"I called him twice and left messages he didn't bother to answer. I had additional information to give him on the T.J. D'Artes autopsy. Maybe it's insignificant, maybe not."
"What kind of information?"
"I know there's a bullseye painted on your back, Dave. I wanted to get all the information right, including the possibility that D'Artes was a bad guy and responsible for your wife's death, even though that's not my job."
"Go on," I said.
"The blood work showed he was legally drunk when he expired. His wife said he was an epileptic and took anti-seizure medication and wasn't supposed to drink, but he drank anyway, and a lot. She also said he knocked her around. Anyway, I wanted to pass on the info, but the department's affirmative action homophobe doesn't seem interested.
You left this on his machine?
Enough so he would know it's important.
I'll get back with you shortly, I said. I hung up and went into Labiche's office. The message light on his phone was blinking. Got any problem talking with Cormac Watts? I asked.
Not as long as he stays off our toilet seats, he replied.
How's it feel?
How does what feel?
Being you, a full-time shithead?
You way out of line, Robichaud.
Try this. You're ignoring forensic evidence in a homicide investigation. You're querying the prosecution's case before it ever hits the prosecutor's desk.
Querying?
It's the old term for screwing up or delegitimizing.
I've got to remember that. You're a mountain of information, Robo.
I'm going to give you 5 minutes to haul your sorry ass into Helen's office and tell her what you've got.
I'll think about it.
I walked to his desk and picked up the receiver from his phone. I thunked it into the middle of his forehead and replaced it in the cradle. His cheeks drained. A pink half-moon pulsed under his hairline. 5 minutes, I said. That night, I tried to reach into the blackout where I had disappeared from the world of normal people. Experience had taught me that chemically induced amnesia has no cure. Your memory does not return at a convenient time. You do not walk from an airless black cell in Alcatraz's infamous D-block into sunlight and rationality. In all probability, you have permanently destroyed thousands of brain cells, just as though you had struck yourself in the head with a ball-peen hammer. But sometimes the problem is psychological rather than neurological. If so, there is a way you can unspool the nightmare that your conscious mind might not want to accept. Unfortunately, the method is imperfect and dangerous. You can become convinced you have committed horrific acts when in fact you have not. Your ordinary dreams can contain bits and pieces of a larger event. In my case, an encounter with T.J. D'Artes on a narrow two-lane parish road out by Bayou Benoit. The process is like reassembling a sheet of gray and black stained glass fallen from a church window to a flagstone floor. For me, that meant images flashing like a kaleidoscope deep down inside my sleep. The glare of headlights in my rearview mirror. A vehicle gnashing against my bumper. Fences and weeds whirling around me. The leering face of an unshaved man with greasy black hair and nails rimmed with dirt, his eyes lit by the fires of stupidity and ignorance and rage. In none of my dreams, however, was I striking a man with my fists, or choking, or stomping and kicking him. How could I have killed a man with my bare hands, or with a club, and not have any trace of the crime in my unconscious? I wanted to believe I had set myself free, but I didn't. Another image remained with me, one that had nothing to do with the event by Bayou Benoit. Instead, I saw him behind the wheel of his truck, his tires squealing around the curve that led to the intersection Molly was entering. His face dilated and drunk with the power the pedal transferred up his leg and into his genitals. I wanted to kill him even worse than I'd wanted to kill Mac, the man who helped destroy my family. I wanted to break his bones and destroy his face with my fists. I wanted to do other things I will not describe. I harbored emotions that no Christian should ever have. But they were mine. I owned them, and they still lived within me, even though T.J. D'Artes was lying on a slab as cold and bloodless as stale lunch meat. Was I capable of the homicide out by Bayou Benoit? You tell me.
Chapter 15.
Saturday morning, I put out another can of sardines for our raccoon friend, whom I named Monty Coon. I had not heard Alifair come in from Red's Health Club the night before. She walked up behind me, a mug of coffee in her hand. She was wearing white shorts and a long-sleeved denim shirt with the tails hanging out. She told me about her encounter with Emmeline Nightingale.
She's a little otherworldly.
A human icicle, I said.
She has dirty eyes.
You think she hit the ball in your face deliberately?
That's what I felt like after I talked with her. She's a controller. She also seems to have an obsession with oil companies. What's the story on that?
Jimmy has a degree in geology. He worked in South America a while. The Nightingales have their fingers in lots of pies.
She sat down in a white-painted wooden chair near Tripod's hutch. The sky was blue and as shiny as silk. Leaves from the live oaks were tumbling on her hair and skin. I couldn't believe she was the little girl I'd pulled from the cabin of a submerged plane. She left me with a disturbing sensation, Alifair said, one I couldn't shake driving home.
Like what?
Evil.
You think she's going to call you?
Probably. She seems interested in the treatment I'm doing on Levon Broussard's Civil War novel.
Maybe that's a project you should drop, Alf.
Because of her?
Because it's going to drag you into contact with Levon and his wife. I think Rowena Broussard is a sick person.
You don't believe she was raped?
She's an unhappy person who has a tendency to work out her problems on the backs of other people.
That's two-thirds of Hollywood, she said.
Did you talk to Levon about the treatment?
On the phone. He said it was fine with him, but he thought it was a waste of time.
What do you think?
It's really good. The battle scenes at Shiloh, the Yankee occupation, the story of the slave girl and her white father who founded Angola Prison.
Why hasn't someone adapted it?
Confederates are the new Nazis. Have you seen the raccoon again?
Not yet. He'll be back, I said.
Are you okay, Dave?
You bet.
Shit, she said. Shit, shit, shit.
Don't use that kind of language, Alf. She put down her coffee mug and stood up and hugged me and pressed her face into my shoulder. I felt the wetness in her eyes. What's this about? I said. She wiped her eyes on my shirt.
Answer me, Alifair. I hate what they're doing to you, she said. I'd like to shoot every motherfucking one of them.
Don't use that language in our home. She hit me again and again, her fists bouncing on my chest.
The social worker in Jennings was named Carolyn Ardwin. She was a matronly, white-haired woman with lovely skin and a blush on her cheeks and soft hands. When Cleet's cell phone woke him up at 8:05 on Monday morning, he was surprised by how happy he felt to receive her call. He had met her only once in her office to talk about Kevin Penny's 11-year-old boy. Their conversation had been all business, with little time to speak of anything other than the child's safety. But her perfume and her manner and the freshness of her clothes lingered with him.
"I hope I didn't call too early, Mr. Purcell," she said.
"No, ma'am, I was just about to head to the office."
"I'm probably not supposed to make this call, but you're such a nice man, and I know you want to be apprised of Homer's situation."
She paused as though reluctant to continue.
"We're reinstating him with Mr. Penny today."
"At the trailer?"
"Yes, a little earlier than I expected. But if not now, we would be taking him there later, and the circumstances wouldn't be any different."
"What time today?"
"At noon sharp."
"This troubles me, Miss Carolyn, mightily."
Why had he used such a strange word?
"Mr. Purcell?"
"Yes."
The time seemed to drag like a chain down the stairs.
"I'm terribly perturbed about this placement," she said finally.
"I'm going to drop by the trailer."
"I know you're a good man," but don't be confrontational with him. You know whom he'll punish.
I'll call you later, he said. I promise everything will be all right.
No, it won't. But you're kind to say that. You're a good man, sir.
He felt a blooming sensation in his chest that he couldn't explain. Cleet drove to Lafayette and made a purchase at a sporting goods store, then got on I-10 to Jennings.
Homer Penny had no memory of his mother, a meth addict and an attractive black prostitute whom her husband Kevin pimped out to middle-class white men from Lake Charles and Lafayette, including a well-known physician. Homer seldom spoke and always looked uncertain or frightened, as though standing in a canoe or pirogue about to topple into a bayou filled with snakes. He had big ears and blue eyes and pale gold skin with big brown freckles like human camouflage. Cleet could never get him to smile. Cleet pulled up in front of the trailer at 11:45. The dirt bike was gone. At noon, a man in a state car came up the track, bouncing in the potholes, the passenger's head barely visible above the dashboard. The passenger wore horn-rimmed glasses and a hand-folded paper hat, and had big ears and a tiny nose and a thin face and slits for eyes, and made Cleet think of a baby seabird peeping out of a nest. The driver parked and got out. He wore a dark blue coat that had dandruff on the shoulders.
"Are you Mr. Purcell?"
Cleet climbed out of the caddy, a shopping bag in his hand. "I am."
"I'm Herb Smith, with the state. Miss Carolyn said you'd be here. Looks locked up?"
"It is." Smith twisted his wrist to read his watch.
3 minutes to noon.
He squeezed his eyes shut and clicked them open again like the eyelids on a mechanical doll. "What?" Cleet said.
"Some days I hope certain people don't show up."
"I brought something for Homer," Cleet said. He opened the sack so Smith could see inside. "You mind?"
"No, sir. Go right ahead."
Cleet removed an Astros baseball cap and a softball and two gloves. "How about it, pal?" he asked the boy.
"I never played," the boy said, his gaze askance.
"We're going to change that. You get over there, and I'll start lobbing them to you. Then you fireball them back."
The boy couldn't catch with a wheelbarrow. He tripped and fell down when he ran after the ball. He couldn't throw 30 feet.
"Tell you what," Cleet said. He went back to the caddy. "I got you a bat. I'll pitch him, you hit him."
Homer missed the first two pitches, clipped the third, and hit the fourth squarely, ripping it across the grass. The welfare man from the state volunteered as catcher. It was 12:26. "Do I have to stay here, Mr. Cleet?" the boy said.
"For a time. Mr. Smith and Miss Carolyn and I will be looking in on you."
The boy swung the bat at nothing. At 12:37, they heard the whine of a dirt bike. The boy's face drained. Cleet saw Smith mouth the words, "Son of a bitch." Kevin Penny cut the gas feed and coasted up to the caddy. He had a backpack. He pulled on the neck of his T-shirt and wiped his nose with it.
"The big three. I'll call it the 2½.
"I need your signature and I'll be gone," Smith said.
"What day of the month does the check come?"
Penny said.
"Pardon?"
"It's supposed to be in the agreement, the amount and the date of delivery."
"I think you'll find everything in order," Smith said.
"Oh, hell yes,"
Penny said. He unslung his pack and walked past his son to the porch, grinding the Astros cap into the boy's scalp. Penny sat on the top step and opened a can of Bud and began tearing apart a rotisserie chicken from his pack and eating it with his hands.
"Don't let me stop you."
Cleet pitched the ball to Homer, but the boy let the bat stay on his shoulder and watched the ball drop into the dirt.
"Strike one,"
Penny said. Cleet took off his fielder's glove and walked to the porch. He curled the glove into a cone and tucked it between Penny's thigh and the railing.
"There's little league ball in Jennings.
Reach me those napkins in my pack, will you?" Penny said.
Cleet didn't answer.
Penny said something with his mouth full of meat. "What's that you say?" Cleet asked. Penny cleared his throat and laughed.
"I thought that perfume come from the welfare office would be here. Instead, I'd get you."
"I'll be running along now."
"Want a thigh?"
Penny raised the chicken and the grease-pooled foil to Cleet's face. Cleet walked to the caddy, a sound in his ears like tank treads clanking or the mewing of barnyard animals caught inside an unbearable flame. He bent down to Homer.
"I'll be back to see you, pal. I'm on your side. So are Miss Carolyn and Mr. Smith."
The boy was not listening. His eyes were wide, his bottom lip trembling as he stared at his father. Cleet could remember little of driving back to New Iberia, nor could he remember when he'd had a sadder day or a greater sense of foreboding.
That afternoon, Helen caught me in the corridor. "In my office, Dave."
I followed her inside and shut the door.
"The prosecutor is on my butt about the D'Arthez investigation," she said.
"He doesn't like how it's going?"
"He thinks you should be on the desk.
Remind me of that come the next election."
Helen was silhouetted against the window, her face covered with shadow. I didn't know if I'd made her angry or not.
"I made a mistake assigning Labiche to the case," she said. "He wants your job."
Finally, I thought.
"I talked to a couple of people in Dade and Broward counties. They said he took freebies in Liberty City, but that's about all they knew of."
"Any vice cop who'll take freebies will take money."
"In this instance, there's no evidence of that," she said.
"Come on, Helen. If a cop is dirty, he can be blackmailed. He can also be killed."
"All right," she said, giving up. She had gone to extraordinary lengths for me many times. I took no pleasure in her concession. "Helen, I think everything we're talking about is much bigger than Labiche or me or T.J. D'Arthez or Jimmy Nightingale. I think it has to do with narcotics, with all the trafficking that starts in Florida and comes straight down I-10 into our midst."
"The crack trade in Jefferson Davis Parish isn't the big score, Dave."
"We're the Walmart of the drug culture. Kids deal dope while they line up to go to a movie."
Her face was still in shadow.
"I don't think the D'Arthez homicide is prosecutable, at least not at this point. I'm telling that to the prosecutor and leaving it in his hands. Prepare yourself."
"For what?"
"We'll be accused of covering up. Look at me, Dave."
I knew what was coming.
"Tell me you didn't do it. Or at least tell me that deep in your heart, you believe you didn't do it."
"I can't do that."
"God damn it," she said.
"Don't swear."
She turned her back to me and stared out the window. The wind was blowing in City Park, the boughs of the oak trees swirling, a motorboat towing a water skier, furrowing the bayou. I wanted to say something of a consoling nature, but I had nothing to offer.
Cleet Purcell normally referred to cop shows on television as the most recent shit Hollywood is foisting on really stupid people. Cleet's intolerance aside, the facsimile has little to do with the reality. Probably one-third of cops are dedicated to the job. One-third eat too many donuts, and one-third are people who should not be given power over others. Female detectives do not show off their cleavage. Many cops carry a drop or a throwdown. Cops plant evidence and lie on the stand. In our midst are sadists and racists who taint the rest of us. And the greatest contributor to solving crimes is not the lab, but the informant, usually someone who skipped toilet training and couldn't make a peanut butter sandwich with a diagram. For Cleet, at least in the Acadiana area, that man was Pookie the Possum Domingue. Pookie had the eyes and snout of his namesake and walked in the same unsteady, desultory fashion, his head wobbling on his spindle of a neck. Years ago, he was a gopher for the Teamsters in Lafayette when they were cheating their own members out of their union books. He also racked balls in Antler's pool hall and did scut work for a bail bondsman,
shilled for the card dealers in the old Lafayette underpass area, and washed money with no duh Dulowitz at Evangeline Downs in the fairgrounds. But his great talent lay in what he called research. Though the Internet had put most PIs out of work, Pookie was unfazed. His knowledge of the netherworld could be matched only by the caretakers of the La Brea tar pits. He called Cleet at his office on Tuesday morning.
Is that you, Purcell?
Who's this?
You keeping your plunger under control?
All right, wise guy, if this is who I think it is,
dial it down. I got some information for you. I was in Styx this afternoon.
Where?
Styx Billiards in Lafayette. We got a bad connection here?
I know where you live, Pookie. Smart off one more time and I'm going to stuff you into a hamster cage.
I'm only asking for a little respect here.
I apologize, but I don't need termites in my building or in my head. Now what do you want?
I was shooting some 8-ball, taking down this blimp with an ass on him like a wash tub, when guess which two clowns come through the door and blow my action. To be more specific, guess which two guys announced to everybody in the place, "Hey, Pookie, glad to see you not 86 no more. Leave us the bones."
"Sorry I missed this world-shaking event," Cleet said.
"Put the cork in it, Purcell. It was Juju and Maximo. Both of them looked like somebody tried to screw their heads into a fire hydrant."
"That breaks me up."
"And maybe it should, because the first thing they ask is if I've seen you around. I told him you got an office in New Iberia. So Maximo says, 'No, that ain't what we asked. We don't need nobody to tell us how to use the phone book. We're asking where that fat shit hangs out. Where's he get his knob polished? That kind of thing.'"
"Somebody put you up to this?"
"I'm trying to do a favor here."
"The last favor you did was to talk your mother out of committing suicide because she defecated you into the world."
There was a pause.
"I'll say this once. Juju ain't a bad guy. The tomato picker with him has done 8 or 9 contract hits. The word is Tony the Nose bought your markers. If that's true, pay him or find an igloo on the North Pole."
"There are no Eskimos on the North Pole."
"You can be the first."
The line went dead. Cleet took his .38 snub from its holster and flipped out the cylinder, rotating it idly with his thumb.
What to do? Nothing. Let them come to him. There was nothing like a bullet in the center of the forehead to get your point across. His thoughts were self-serving, and he knew it. The guy who blew out your wick was always a nasty little hornet like Maximo, a disposable psychopath who watched Saturday morning cartoons and had a 300-pound mistress whose lap he sat in for a photograph and then put the photo on the Internet. Cleet found the business card that Carolyn Ardwin had given him and dialed the cell number on it.
"I thought I'd ring and let you know I'll be checking on Homer as often as I can," he said.
"Mr. Smith told me you bought Homer a ball and glove and bat. That was probably one of the best gifts that boy ever had."
"I happened to see them on sale."
"I don't think you give yourself enough credit, Mr. Purcell."
Cleet couldn't remember why he had called. Or maybe he did. It wasn't easy to talk to normal women.
"Is the weather pretty nice over there?"
"In Jennings?" she said.
"Yeah, it's a couple parishes over from us. I wondered if the weather was the same."
"I'm pretty sure it's like yours, in New Iberia."
"There's a swell day here."
"Are you worried about Homer?"
"I was also wondering, you know, are you a married lady? I mean, I didn't see you wearing a wedding ring."
"You saw correctly. I am not married. I was widowed when I was 23.
"I've enjoyed our talks and meeting you," he said. "3 or 4 times a year I go fishing thereabouts, south of Jennings, I mean."
"Are you trying to tell me something, Mr. Purcell?"
"I was wondering if you like movies."
"I love them," she said.
"There are some good ones playing in Lafayette.
There's a dinner club close by that I'm fond of, too.
I think I know the place.
Miss Carolyn, could I motor on by your home this evening?
I'd like that very much.